KALW.
Dad told me on the plane ride that we had two new players. I just had a sense that things were different in Oakland.
Today, we revisit the Oakland A's glory years and consider its future.
Are they really going to move on after Sacramento? And why not stay in Oakland if they're going to Vegas?
It's the next episode of Foul Ball. Then we go backstage with an Oakland singer right before their first Stern Grove performance.
I looked at my little mirror. I just left it at home. I left my makeup brushes. So we're getting really crafty.
And a reading from Sonoma County author Bridget Quinn.
It's a story about reclaiming a woman's life and work from the ashes of revolution.
A reading from our pocket-sized book tour, New Arrivals. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The Oakland A's are currently at last place in the Western Division of Baseball, but they've picked up a few unexpected wins. Today, we'll start the show with the next episode of Foul Ball. Here's the host, KALW's Sunni Khalid.
The A's are back home this weekend at the Coliseum facing the Giants in what will be the last Bay Bridge series between the two teams. And although Oakland is still bringing up the rear in the American League's West Division, the squad has been on a bit of a roll since the All-Star break. Believe it or not, they have the best record in the American League since July 1st. They took 2 of 3 at home from the Chicago White Sox, the team with the worst record in the major leagues, and then traveled north of the border for a weekend series in Toronto against the Blue Jays. After dropping the first game of the series, the A's bounced back in Game 2 against Toronto on Saturday. Once again, it was left fielder designated hitter Brent Rooker providing the heroics at the plate.
And now Brent Rooker.
And this one in the air towards left field. It's going back and right. Leaping up is Joey Loperfido. So Rooker getting into second. He thought that ball had a chance to go out. Just kept carrying, and Loperfido got a glove on it, but just knocked it down.
Upon the field with the ball is in play, not a home run. This will be a creep chief review.
Oh, yeah. Hits the top of the wall, bounces back and hits the rail, and then comes back into the field to play. If that ball hits the top of the wall and then hits the rail, he's asking, shouldn't that be a homer?
After review, the call on the field is overturned.
Uh-huh.
It is a home run.
That's right. Atta baby, Cots, go get you a long ball.
So Brent Rooker finishing his home run trot as he rounds third, and it is a 1-0 ball game.
Rooker's 29th home run of the season was the only one the A's needed, the only one in the game, as starting pitcher Osvaldo Beto and three relievers shut out the Blue Jays on 2 hits. The next game, there was no shortage of fireworks. The A's scored 6 runs in the first inning en route to an 8-4 win over Toronto. This time, J.J. Bladé and Zach Geloff went yard.
J.J. Bladé towards right field. The ball is going to leave the ballpark. A 2-run homer for J.J. Bladé and a 3-0 game. 3 batters up, 3 runs in. Gotta love the feels on a Sunday.
Hit by pitch, so the first 4 reach here against Chris Bassett.
First pitch swing for Zach Geloff. That ball carrying out towards left field. And see you later. The Zach attack in full force here in Toronto. A 2-run homer and a 5-0 lead.
Sunday's victory was a milestone for the A's. They won their 50th game of the season, as many as they won last year. When you're in last place, nearly 20 games under 500, and have the lowest payroll and attendance in the major leagues, you savor your successes whenever you can. In the last episode, I spoke with Roger Knoll, a professor emeritus at Stanford University, about the A's move next season to Sacramento and eventually to Las Vegas in 2028. This week, I had a conversation with Nancy Finley, the cousin of Charlie Finley, the man who moved the A's from Kansas City to Oakland in 1968. She's the author of Finley Ball. The book gives an insider's account of Charlie Finley's tumultuous 20-year ownership of the Athletics, including the glory of the team's 3 consecutive World Series championships in the 1970s, as well as the team's decline and inevitable sale.
I I can't imagine moving to a much smaller place. And I would want to know, are they really going to move on after Sacramento? And why not stay in Oakland if they're going to Vegas? That's a lot of expense moving to Sacramento.
So you empathize with the 230 employees that are going to be laid off?
Yes, because I wonder if they had not left, if they were going to just wait and go to Vegas, the people would still be here, I'm sure, unless they were going to phase it out. It's just hard to see that happen all at once.
What are your memories of those early days with the A's and going to the Oakland Coliseum and the excitement with the A's moving to Oakland?
The day after I moved to Oakland, I wanted to see the Coliseum because all I knew was Kansas City. And that's where I went. And then I remember being in the conference room, which was also double as Charlie's office, but he was never there. And so there was a line of people waiting to meet me. And people would walk in one at a time because I guess they wanted to see Carl's daughter. Dad was a bachelor running everything himself. Joe DiMaggio had just made both of them an Italian dinner the week before in the penthouse. So they were friends.
Your father became the general manager. He was one of the architects of the first sporting dynasty in the Bay Area, which was those swinging A's teams of the early and mid-1970s. At that time, you had Reggie Jackson, Sal Bando, Joe Rudy, Raleigh Fingers. Vida Blue had just been signed.
That's what the 1960s encompassed, was building the team, because I've heard how bad we were, but we were building. Dad was in there helping to hire the players. I remember hearing that Alvin Dark in 1967, the day he was fired amicably, he predicted our players would be in the 71 playoff. This was 67.
And this was at a time when the American League was lagging behind the National League in signing African-American players.
Oh, yes. And Dad told me on the plane ride to Oakland that we had two new players, Reggie Jackson and Vida Blue. I could tell he was very proud. I just had a sense that things were different in Oakland. And also, Dad was very good friends with Rick Monday. Rick Monday helped Dad with the move. See, to me, I never knew that because it was natural to have all races around. I never heard about any of this. I'm hearing it. I've heard it in the last few years, but it's shocking to hear what teams were doing. I couldn't believe some of the things I've heard.
Well, the A's started winning. They were in the playoffs in 70 and then 72, 73, and 74.
71 was the first playoff that we lost. So, you know, we're entitled to a movie since we lost that year.
What do you remember about that year, 71?
71 was, it was just amazing to me that we went that far. And when we didn't win the playoff, to me, it was like, well, we achieved this. We got this far. So I didn't expect the World Series, but I was really young too. But yeah, I didn't want us to lose either, but I was just so happy we got that far.
Describe what it was like, the feeling between the team and between the city in those early years.
What I do remember is in the evening, I would see the Kaiser Center with a big A in lights. But I really didn't hear much about the city doing something separate. And that was always odd to me that they seemed to wait for us to do something. I guess I thought the city would put up our colors in downtown and just have a lot more than I saw. I wasn't sure if they knew what to do with the team because I know we were new. We were the first team, first owner. So sometimes I wonder if people look back and think, oh, Charlie wasn't so bad after all.
He was the first one to champion use of the designated hitter.
73. I remember champagne bottles opening January 1st, 73. Now, question, why was he reviled? I've had people ask me that.
He was reviled after 74 because this was when he was trying to get rid of some of the star players.
Was that because of free agency in 75? Was 75?
75. They wanted to get paid.
That trial in 76, I mentioned that in my book. That was a result of free agency. In fact, I remember when he and Dad would talk and wonder why the other owners weren't brainstorming ways to bring free agency in. They didn't seem to want to care to talk about it. Charlie was the only one that had a formula for that, and it didn't happen. And then they didn't like it. The owners complained about it later. Okay, being ribald, though, about that, to me, is different than earlier. Now, Charlie has admitted, he admitted that the worst mistake he ever made. Catfish Hunter had some kind of stock or savings, and Charlie was supposed to pay it on the first, and they always give you a two-week leeway. Charlie, as an insurance person, would wait till the last day. Dad warned him over and over he shouldn't really do that. And so when Catfish had a new agent, the agent went through the fine print and saw that loophole. And Charlie had always paid late. But that time they said, well, you paid late, so we can get out of it. But Charlie admitted that was one of his biggest mistakes.
Well, you had so many colorful characters. He was the first one to encourage players to wear facial hairs.
He paid them for a barbershop mustache. Whoever could do that.
So he had Raleigh Fingers with the famous handlebar mustache. He gave the names. Jim Hunter became Catfish Hunter.
That's right. And now, do you know what his middle name was?
No.
Augustus, which was my father's middle name. They got a laugh about that.
All right. Well, the A's got rid of their stars. They fell on hard times. And in 1980-81, Charlie Finley sold the A's to Walter Haas, and the Haas family started this resurgence.
But back up to 1977, Dad and Charlie said, we're going to rebuild. We're going to rebuild quietly. That meant starting over, listening to your offsite scouts. That's how we got Ricky Henderson and all the other players that ended up really doing great. In fact, Billy Martin was the last person Dad got. Dad wanted Billy. He negotiated for Billy at the 79 Winters meeting. Charlie did not. And that people say Charlie got Billy. No, Charlie had tried to negotiate for Billy in the past and it fell through. Just didn't work out. So Dad said he needed to be the one to do it. Dad was good friends with Billy. So Billy came on with Mickey Morabito. And we started doing great. But the thing that caused the sale was the lawsuit we were served in 79. And I remember when that happened. It was when the season started and the city of Oakland, Alameda County, and Coliseum Board sued the team. And the causes of action was just amazing. It was terrible. One was that our roster wasn't up to MLB standards. Our roster. And Ricky Henderson was on that roster. So Dad wondered how they were going to prove that. Well, what happened was our attorney ended up having it thrown out in July of 79. But in the meantime, some friends of Dad said that they thought it was a real dangerous time for me and Dad being in Oakland. They were worried that with all the bad press we were having, that someone might physically harm me or Dad and think it's okay because there was so much negative about Finley. And Charlie was far away, so he was fine. But Dad was real worried about my safety. Dad talked Charlie into selling. Yes, he did. Charlie, I see how Charlie just really did what Dad said if Dad put his foot down.
What is going to be your strongest memory?
Oh, our dynasty. And then rebuilding, because when we were entering the 81 playoffs after that long strike, that was more than 90% of our scouted players. We did it again. I was able to observe Dad better. You're not in the 60s, but this time. And I just thought, wow, he can rebuild fast. Dad and Charlie, fast. That was their talent. Otherwise, I mean, it was sad that the team had sold because you know, it would have been good to have Dad with Charlie. So it was amazing to me that we rebuilt to that again.
That was Nancy Finley, author of Finley Ball, speaking with KLW News editor Sunni Khalid. You can find the rest of Sunni's Foul Ball series at klw.org/foulball. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. This summer, thousands of people have packed up their picnic baskets and blankets and grooved out to live music at Stern Grove. And KALW has been front and center, from our coverage to our DJs warming up the crowds with their hand-picked sets of music. But what is it like backstage? KALW's Janae Darden hung out with Oakland artist Satya in her dressing room right before she stepped out to perform.
Okay, so I am here at Stern Grove Festival in Satya's dressing room. I'm excited because, like, I feel like I get to hang out with a rock star.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm, like, you know, I was waking up this morning, so I was very sleepy, but I finally woke up, so now I'm very excited.
Any nerves or jitters or just hyped?
Yes, I feel nervous, but I'm just so excited. Like, we did our sound check and I was like, it's the perfect stage setup. Earlier, I was talking with the band how we've done shows where the stage is massive and we're all so spread out that we can't even see each other. And this is perfect. Everything's like nice and wood and looking at the tree. So it's beautiful.
I'm floating so high. It's too small down there to focus on details. Your facial expression. I'm floating so high.
What's your grounding ritual that you do before you perform?
I light candles a lot and I meditate. So, like, every night before bed, I've just been, I don't know, sitting with myself, lighting a candle, just kind of saying, like, my intentions. And especially for today, like, and this morning, it helps me to envision kind of, like, how I want to feel on stage, you know, like, what emotions I want to feel, how I want to connect to the music. So that's been grounding me.
Okay, so I'm looking around the dressing room, and there's a lot of clothes. Okay, there's a... It's like, company's coming, put the clothes away. So that, like, I see your bandmates clothes.
You got a massage gun.
I see
coconut water. We got a lot of bags. These are all my bags.
I see hair extensions, makeup. Okay, you bring your own mirror? You bring your own makeup mirror?
I forgot so much today. I, like, looked at my little mirror. I just left it at home. I left my makeup brushes. So we're getting really crafty.
Right now. Your makeup looks good because I see your eyes are sparkling and your teeth. So you have some bling on your teeth. It's really cute. Little diamonds right on the side of her, on the side of her teeth.
Yeah, I like them. They've been on a long time.
That's that New Orleans vibe I'm getting.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Oakland, I think, too, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, the South and Oakland.
Same vibe, same thing.
Yeah. So, okay, I see Reese's Pieces. I was like, the big question, I'm like, what snacks? Reese's Pieces, I see chips and salsa. Is there a mandatory snack that you must have?
The Reese's. I just asked my sister. She went to Target. I was like, get me Reese's. What else I needed? I needed her to get me Polaroid film. That's not a snack. But she got that.
It is not a snack.
A sour candy girl. So any sour candy is good. Sour straws, not probably good to eat before singing, but it helps me. Okay. Yeah.
Is there anything that you must have when you are about to perform?
I always put on my necklaces. Like, I'll show you even though. I have certain necklaces that were passed down from my great-grandmother or just, like, things that I usually will, like, put on my altar also before when I'm, like, lighting candles and stuff. So I feel like I, like, charge my jewelry. So I always make sure to have that. And then sometimes I'll just, like, put something special in my guitar case.
Let's go back to the necklaces. So describe the necklaces. I see there's about 3 or 4 necklaces you have on, and they're a mix of gold and silver. Talk about some of the charms and the symbolism, please.
This one is, like, a gold triangle charm. I don't know what, like, shape you would call this.
It's triangle with a stone
triangle
in the middle.
With a stone in the middle. It's, like, I don't actually know what stone it is, but it's kind of like an orange, like amber kind of stone. But yeah, my great-grandmother, like on my mom's side, gave it to me before she passed away, like a year before she passed away. And I feel like that gives me good luck and reminds me of her. And then This one is on a gold chain, and then it's an amethyst. I like the shape of it because it's not like a perfect shape. It has a little missing corner on it. But I went into my sister's work and I saw it and I felt very drawn to it. And I feel like amethyst is very good for just like anxiety and to calm nerves. And
it's pretty.
Thank you.
There's one that looks like an eye. Is that an eye?
Yeah. This one's really special. It's a it's like evil eye.
People in the West African.
Yeah. Just like it's, I see it as like protection. And it was really special, and it was like my partner's sister's, so they gave it to me. So it's just it's a special thing that like reminds me of her too.
And what do you put in your guitar case?
I put a little crystal in there, and sometimes I put stuffed animals in there. I have a dragon stuffed animal.
Cute, cute.
He comes with me.
Satya, thank you so much for your time. Because I know like you're about to go on stage soon. So thank you so much. Good luck. I know you're going to rock it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This one's for my pookies from Oakland.
That was singer Satya speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. Satya's latest soulful EP is called Deep Blue. The Stern Grove concert series runs every weekend through August 25th.
Yeah, love on my body, kiss on my brain. Love on you in a natural state, it's true. And oh well, you could say everything's been changing. Now you can't catch a break.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Up next, we'll hear about a long-ignored artist and feminist of 18th century France. It's a reading from New Arrivals, our pocket-sized book tour. Bridget Quinn lives in Sonoma County. Her book is called Portrait of a Woman. It's a story about reclaiming a woman's life and work from the ashes of revolution. Picture Hamilton or Amadeus, but with women artists. Here's an early section from the book. In the decades since first encountering Adelaide Le Billard, I've been visited by her in ways big and small, via dreams and waking thoughts, via messages on stickers, T-shirts, and museum wall labels. On her behalf, I've spent a fortune on esoteric books, and I've followed her on many inadvisable quests. But like a pilgrim tracking down the arm bone of a saint, I needed to view a painting, see an exhibition, get a glimpse of Adelaide once more. Many times I tried to write her story in the typical biographical or art historical ways, but she objected. I gave up, restarted, gave up again. But resistance is futile, and that is how I find myself quoting Star Trek in a story about 18th century French art. I have relinquished control. Jesus, take the wheel. Or in this case, Adelaide. That was Sonoma County author Bridget Quinn reading from her book, Portrait of a Woman. It came out in April. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse, and you can find more readings from local authors at klw.org/newarrivals. Tune in Monday morning at 11. On the first day of the Democratic National Convention, we ask, who's the real Kamala Harris?
So I decided I was going to start prosecuting parents for truancy. Well, this was a little controversial in San Francisco.
Her journey to become the city's district attorney. That's Monday morning at 11. And here's some music from a local artist before we say goodbye.
don't you come down when it's the right time? I bet you're in the stars when they're around or in the daylight, daylight.
This is San Francisco's Zelma Stone. You can see them perform live this Sunday at the Independent.
Do you need me to see you?
Today's Cross Currents team includes Arun Nair, Afton Okwu, Julia Haney, Cherie Bishop, James Rowlands, Ganadijo Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shirin Adil, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.